To then be able to evaluate those things that he's reactive to and those things he actually chooses. Now he may, you know, it's just like the old story, you know, well, I'm going to give my children better than I had. So what do you think when you think of what's better? First you've got to think, well, now this I liked in my childhood, I enjoyed. At least I remember enjoying in my childhood. And these things I didn't like. And so, I mean, I'm going to try to protect my children from that kind of thing. But unless it's a mature and unreactive decision, it can be very bad, because supposing you came from a very poor household, and so your reactive feeling is, I want to give my children everything. And then those children grow up and say, well, I want to give my children true things, a true value. And they try to give their children true value, and those children grow up and they react in another way. So that's if you keep having generations of reactive things, then there's nothing true in it. Because the mature person has to say, if I grew up in this kind of a household, I'd come to these kind of conclusions. I could. And if I grew up in this kind of a household, I'd come to these kind of conclusions. What are the real conclusions? I mean, that, to me, that must mean maturity, when you can stop being reactive to just what you happen to have seen, or happen to have been born in, or happen to have read. And it has to be dug out so that you speak from a broader knowledge than your own very small world as a child, because you don't even know as a child what your parents gave you, all the good things. You're not going to be reactive again. You're going to just accept those. I mean, that's just part of life, you know, but it wasn't part of somebody else's life. Mm-hmm. And so that even becomes reactive to not even caring. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, if everything you do in your adult life merely stems from those things in your childhood that you happen to remember, or for some reason at the point up, you know, whatever. I was telling Steve, you know, about this, you know, whole reaction he had with his brother. I said, you know, you don't really know how much your parents gave to you. You don't really know. You were having a battle with your brother. It was separate from your parents. It really wasn't anything your parents could do. You had to win that battle, whatever it was. And it was just like, it was Rachel and me. if Rachel didn't come out, you know, successful in her life, was able to say, you know, I've been able to do all these things, I'm successful in all these things, that she'd still be battling with me. Yeah, because it was that's the beginning of her life, when you begin to battle with your peer, your siblings. And the same thing was true, you know, when Woody was born. I didn't expect there to be any reaction between the two. But Robin had tremendous jealousy of Woody. But it was when she saw Woody's relationship to the world and worried that maybe he was getting something she wasn't getting. And it really didn't matter what I did in that situation. I mean, even to have stepped in and settled it between them, then wouldn't have allowed her to win her own battle, to win her own relationship with the world, that she says, well, Woody is like that and I'm like this, and I'm happy being where I am, and I'm very happy with the way he is. And she's quite, you know, or achieving that right now. She's achieving it through her own independence, because Woody came at the worst stage, really, for her. It upsets her status quo in the home. And now, you know, she's beginning to have value in her own relationship to the world. She can now begin to accept Woody and not fear that he's getting more than she is. And even say in some cases he's getting a lot less. You know, it's because, you know, of my ways, but if you're not allowed to have that battle, then
it does become a wound.
Yeah, then you go on, you know, battling it the rest of your life. I mean, like Robin was reactive to Woody, and she tried all the things that his ways. Which is like Robin, and they didn't fit. It was all very funny. I mean, she always thought we'd do the black, you know, body here with the 12-year-old kid landing on you plump, and it didn't turn out the same. But there really wasn't anything to do except to try to let the thing happen.
Seems like nature is so cunning. Too, they always seem to make you two children brought into a family the exact opposite. I mean, you know, like Steve and his brother and you and Rachel and his. Or do you make each other the exact opposite of what? It's probably one of the family that you make you. I mean, maybe it's in the environment as much as the
personality. Well, I think I agree in the kind of the society we live in, which is very structured, well, it's less structured than the Indian cultures and the ancient cultures, where everything is set there. It really makes you pretty secure. You know what you're going to do each season. The seasons help you to know what you're going to do.
Society doesn't
let
you out either.
No, and everything is kind of, you know, has this tradition and it has this necessity and so on, and there you are. Well, our society allows you more, but it also, unless you can raise the children to adapt to it, it causes the neurosis. But the neurosis in itself is actually an excellent thing, because that's what will develop the growth. And when Bellheim says that, you know, that there are some children born into some families that just should be taken out, put into different families. Mm-hmm. They just cannot adjust.
The family can adjust to them.
Either way. And he states cases where there's been one child who he's removed, put in school, and at that time, the mother and father were about to go into a divorce. The other children were quite upset. One child is removed, mother and father go back together, the other children are fine. And And so he just throws this out. Even if it's not a conclusion, he just throws this out. And I think it's very true, but I think that the answer to that is that sometimes when we have developed this freedom beyond the neurosis stage, because neuroses are made by these amount of choices which you don't know how to choose. If you didn't have the choice, you don't have that kind of a neurosis in a farm society. You may have few individuals who really go off and they're put in an attic or something, but you don't have this many people caring for neurosis. And so if you can develop a society where the only rules really are what harms other people, and where a household doesn't have to be set up. I mean, lots of Woody was born into a suburban family who had, a lot of values of material things that they worked very hard for, and for education in the future, and this sort of thing. Woody would, to carve Woody into that kind of a mold would mean they'd have a lot of tremendous problems. I mean, right from the time he was one, they'd have tremendous problems. And by the time he was five, he would be going to probably to a college, and somebody in the family would be very, on how strong or weak the mother was. But yet, if we could, and it is true that there are children, like I've seen children in the kindergarten, and come in, and the very thing that they are having difficulty with in this world happens to be the traits that are the best traits for a different society.
That's what makes a lot of people great.
And you just have to say, if you could just take this child and put him over in this island here, or over in Japan, or one of these other
islands. Out of Kenya, the majority of people that are in insane asylums are future people, and they act only from love. But they're not competitive people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're put there by their competitive family, who see right away that they'll never adjust to what they consider normality. And she's made a study of this. If there are people like this guy, he had a book that he wrote. He was a German, and he was from this family, and this German family, they all worked, very hard. And they had six brothers, and they all wanted the land. And they didn't want to divide it. They wanted to keep them all there, And this sixth brother, he was a kind of he didn't care for work, he was thinking, he was just an objective person, and didn't care for some competition, didn't even want the land. And during the depression, they looked out, and he was out there turning over the soil with a pitchfork so that the birds wouldn't die. And the birds couldn't get down because of the drought. And so, but while there was work to be done, he was turning over the worms. So the birds, and this was just the end. They got the local judge, they gave the local judge an acre, to sign the paper. And he was 20 years in the insane asylum. And he was the only normal one, really, in the family, because he was the only one without greed or lucky for the land or insanity of work. And the five brothers had the land. They hadn't allowed any of them to leave. They had kept the land intact, and they all were insane from working it. And this brother, he wrote this book about himself. But I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Well, it's just that when a child is born, it's a personality and a moving force is born, and the household has to have a responsibility. I don't say that the individual child has to rule the household anymore, then the parents have to rule the household. But the individual personality, whatever it is, comes into the household and makes demands and changes it, almost as a whole new society coming in. And it shouldn't be in terms of ruling, it should be in terms of change and somehow nurturing this.
Our society is so cruel. I mean, I was talking to George Winter the other day, you know, he can't, his family's so worried. Now, it isn't that they don't love what he's doing, even, but they're so worried that he's not going to be equipped to make a living. I mean, they know what it is, you know.
That's
and they only think that going to university is a way to get yourself equipped. It's the only way they know that you can earn a living. And so they're worried, they push him and they're worried about him.
But you see, they're not wrong.
No, they're not wrong at all. That's what I was telling him, that this is it won't equip them necessarily to earn a living, but in that they believe still that it would.
So the whole point for him is that that he has to figure out is he making the judgment of whatever it is he's doing on a reactive basis to the very strong feelings. I mean, anytime you have a family with very strong feelings, then you have to figure out, are you being reactive? If you're doing the opposite, are you being reactive? If you're doing the same, are you just being under?
But I don't think that's true, because she was really swung into this, you know, not reacting against them.
But
he was swung into it by them. He would never have reacted against them if the movement hadn't, you know, come in like a tide and pushed him.
But he can't also, on the other hand, he can't, if he's not being reactive, he can't ignore their reality.
No, I don't think he doesn't either. He's also kind of just as a servant of his father, as being a hirer, you know, hiring people. Mm-hmm. And his father struggles between his own humanism and getting and paying a difference between $1.25 and $1.50, because that's his profit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's squeezed from the top. He gets 75,000, doesn't get a price, and so his father is insane, you know, between the, and he feels very bad about it, but he feels also bad because now he sees his mother and father's relationship. How his mother hasn't had any relationship with his father, because his father works like, you know, day and night, and didn't ever understand her and her needs. He sees his mother now. Thank you. Well, I think it's very hard in our society to transform the family conflict into social conflict. Or transform your past into a...
Well, I think the biggest difficulty, which is also the good part of our society, is that that values are changing so fast, and this has to do with production, that social values have and political too. Can't keep up with the scientific and technology development, which changes the social and political values. And it seems that the big struggle now is just that, really, and being able to work closer with the scientists, the technology people.
Yeah.
Because they're leading the world right now. And all of these other movements and struggles come under it. And so there's really is a tremendous responsibility on the family and on the school.
Yeah.
Who at least it equals the technology advancement.
And they help the human being to transform his life fast enough.
Right.
So that he isn't just a cul-de-sac of disease.
And in you know, way out areas which haven't even been considered much part of the world, in a generation you have people jumping, you know, from the most primitive land people to being head of tremendous governments in one generation.
Yes.
And that's a...
And the wonderful thing in this watch book, and also some of them has this, that the real hope of the world, this fast-changing world, is that is the lower, the person who is empty. Tao says it's the empty person. You know, it's the vast majority of people that contain the greatest, because they are the emptiest. and more filled, you know, they are filled. And Sufa has this about, it's the common people who have not been filled with the refuse of the 19th and 18th century. You know, who this is true, you see it all the time in Arkansas and Missouri. You can't understand how these people are so full of the future, you know, because they haven't got anything in them.
Well, I think it's more like a volcanic action, you know, because you have that base of the mountain, you know, erupting all the time, but then it becomes the top and has to wait for the next...
Well, that's who they are, though, down below.
Yeah, it has to wait for the next eruption.
Hot, empty people.
But then...
I love that.
But then they base, you know, their eruption bases themselves on the existing mountains.
Oh, the resistance of the crust. Of course, that's also what kept them down below hot and pressure.
But I mean, it wouldn't be happening without the mountain existing, without what the white world built. Maybe they don't know, you know, maybe they got to a point of no control and have not been able to move their values along fast enough and to break with their old traditions of values and keep up with what they're able to do scientifically. But you don't really have to worry about it, because you still have these other people who can do it, who can move from one generation right to where the longest tradition of the white man, even the king or whatever, he can move from where he was on the land to every bit of knowledge that the top white man has. Mm-hmm. Any one individual in one generation can do it. And of course, so he becomes
the
savior of us. But then he's been saved by the very white creature too.
Oh yeah. Well, the crust can never erupt itself. It has to be erupted from below.
Objective in that there is a immediate, there's nothing in it.
I'm sure the spark comes from.
There's immediate reaction for emotion.
I thought it was a real spark. Yeah.
And that you can judge by that. You know what I mean? If Woody has that. See, I mean, you present Woody with a problem. And he looks at it like a problem and immediately goes to a solution of it. He's not hampered by the problem.
Yes, that's true. He goes directly And he may kill himself in this.
Right, oh, yeah.
And he may run into stone wall.
Yeah. But he says, you know, that I conform very much to the child in that way. He didn't compare William, because I was going to talk about William, but he said it seemed to her that there, you know, there'd be a problem, there'd be an immediate reaction to me in going towards a solution. Whether it was solved or not isn't important, but it immediate reaction and action towards the problem, you know, not away from it. And she considers that a realistic view of things, you know, including whatever the problem is, objectives, and
I was worried about your reaction to 2 years about to the whole, I mean, it's an impossible situation, but it seemed like your anger was so destructive to you. I mean, it doesn't seem like it was solving the problem. You got to be so subjective about
it. Well, there wasn't any solution within that structure.
I suppose not.
It only came up to, you know,
do you think that's what caused Granny's anger like that? I mean, it's very similar.
Sure, because if you're going to put yourself in a position of people's toilet cleaning,
you mean,
then you're going to be treated that way.
You never have done it in the first place?
No, it was necessary to do. I wouldn't have done it if there was no time limit on it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have considered doing it if it was going to be my whole life.
Look at Granny did those kind of things and destroyed as much as she created by understanding what she wanted to do or should have done, or what she thought should have been done, and then destroying everything in the
house. Well, yeah, there isn't any solution, but her decision was one of the great protector on the one hand, and then an annoyance of the position it puts you in. But it shouldn't put you in that position, is the point.
I mean, were you wrong in the first place to get in the position? You said you have to, so.
Well, it isn't exactly wrong or right. I mean, people, you know, it's the same thing. I think that, little kids had to be fed. And it was a matter of, you know, 3 years or so. And it was a necessity. The anchor comes when it isn't done properly. And I mean, I was never so mad as when I was. I think I was the maddest when I went into that shower back there and cleaned that tile. You know what that is when the tile turns black? It's dead skin.
It is?
Yeah. It's dead skin.
Dead skin?
That's what it is. And it was thick. Like that on the tile in the shower, you know, because I've not ever used that shower. And I think that was worse than doing the toilets in the last 3 years. I mean, you know, I people use the toilets, you know, and you always have to go in there and brush, and somehow that isn't as bad, and it's fresher. I had gobs of it. I had used a waste of a basket to dump one rag after another.
It comes off in the shower?
Well, I got this very strong cleaner. Yeah. Well, if you ever change, you know, if you leave sheets on a bed for a long time, and then you change them, you know, you find that there's dead skin on it. You know, your skin peels off all the time. Well, in the shower, it just piles up on the tile. If you wash it, it's a dirty, dead skin. And I said, about 4 hours inside that shower, and I was so mad. I was so angry. And Bernie happened to come by. But he wished he'd never come in. He didn't come by that same day. You know, and he walked in and said something about, you know, you don't care about me. And I said, all I care about is your old dead skin. And I was yelling at him. And he didn't know what was coming up. It was a little dead skin out of the shower it was coming up. It's disgusting. Well, that's really the essence of his mission. And I think the other one that really understood that actually was Mandy, when we had this fight with Label. And she was so afraid that was going to be breaking up. And she yelled at him, well, that's the whole reason we moved in here. We want a hot meal every night. And it was true. Uh-huh. And that, you know, that was the whole basis of the argument.
What was his argument? That you wanted him? That you could live without them or what?
No. At that time, you know, I was coming back to the school. I was teaching 6 hours. And then parent conferences came up, and they had to move in.
I didn't hear it. There was a meeting.
And I had asked Label if I had everything ready, and all I have to do is put the meat in the oven or in the frying pan or whatever, and make a salad, and set the table. Mm-hmm. That would be tremendous help. And he wasn't working. And I start out the whole conversation with him. Let's see now, Label, you're not working now, are you? And he said, no, taking his food. And I have to do, I'll do this, you know. And he said, well, I'm not going to make a salad. And I said, well, we need salad with the dinner. And that's part of the dinner. And he said to me, well, no, I'm not going to do that. I mean, if people are hungry, they can just go eat. I said, eat what? And stuff, and so we got in this argument.
Is that what they did over there?
More or less, not Randy cooked. One of the Sunday, I guess, even Sunday cooked something. But not regular, you know. And besides, it's too expensive. And so, anyway, so we got in this argument, and I said, well, if you're not going to participate, you can't be here. So, well, I won't be here then. So that's just fine. Don't be here then. So that was the last meal we ate here.
That was the last meal we ate?
Here, yeah. But which was fine with him. He likes to go to restaurants here. Stuff like that. That was the whole basis that he wouldn't move in here and I had a place in the store. And he would lose his independence too.
Is that his attitude or banana all the time?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. She used to ask him if he wouldn't scrub the floor, you know, and he'd say, well, the floor's all right. You know, just then. Leave it the way it is. I don't mind. And you know, I mean, he really didn't. Yeah, I mean, that place over there was really, really looked like almost like nobody even moved to get it. I mean, everything was so hot and restless. He was sticking a finger on the drink on the floor, and it was a quarter of an inch thick.
What was that? Was a whole year?
But Anne was never able to keep up with the housework. I mean, she used to come over here, and you know, she'd say, "Well, I don't know. Deborah works in the house all the time. Nice, you know." And she never could figure it out because she just didn't have the energy, you know, to do it. And then besides, label in Scripture were impossible. Lincoln and Randy, but they didn't overpower label in Scripture. If they could have, why then?
I mean, this thing, go back to the past. Now, like in Irene and Ethel, you know, they can't dare to go back to Minnesota. You know, because the past, this seems to me to be very dangerous. You know, just think of being from a place, and the past is so undigested in you. You know, or so a horror or a danger, that you can't go back. I mean, Irene and Ethel just would never go back. We were talking about the village. Why is the village in Mississippi so dear to Irene? You know, and the village she wants to go back to Tepoztlan. I mean, why is this miserable and terrible ghetto of Mexico so dear to her, while her own miserable ghetto in Duluth is impossible for her to even stay? You know, I mean,
I think you come as a conquering hero when you go to Mexico. You're in an awfully darling position.
Well, there's something inverted in it, I think. That's true, too, but in Mississippi, too. But there's something inverted in it about your own village. I mean, you're loving it, you're projecting, you know, the grief of your own village to the grief of another people,
but you don't have to be in it, so it's you can have it without having it,
and you can leave.
Yeah, and you know it's a more objective thing, and you also know you choose it.
Yes,
and that's important.
But it seems to me a terrible thing.
It's hard to choose yourself.
I don't think you can ever. I don't think Irene could ever really be of help until she is able to face all those terrible things that happened in Duluth, you know, and her sister and her mother and her brother. You just can't not face them. It's a disease in you, or a horror. And Ethel was saying about Sarabo. She suffered such blows from Sarabo that she couldn't bear to walk down those streets. So she started to talk about it. Anyway, the blows were peculiar. I mean, she found out when her father died, they were unreal, even.
Yeah.
She found out her father was a hero in the town, and well looked upon. He was a great benefactor, and you know, and she thought he was a Jewish junk dealer, and she was saying, I guess the mother told him that. But the mother thought he was, you know, below her. Did you know that her mother's brother was married to Tilly? I didn't know that until the other time. Her mother's brother is his father. Carl, is there a Carl? The first oldest child?
Mm-hmm.
Is that why I was wondering what the relationship was, but you know, she was over there so much. I just thought, well, you know, so they were friends.
Mm-hmm.
This brother also hated her father. You know, he was an educated person and didn't work and came back there, and her mother always sent him money on her father's junk money. Her mother was her educated brother. I guess they were divorced. I mean, then he used to come back there and live, and he was, you know, very superior to everyone, superior to the father. But she thought her father was this terrible, terrible man. So after he died, then she found out that the whole town celebrated. Terrible injury in the police. This tape, but you didn't get to hear this tape, but it's marking. But he talks about going across the border when he was 13, you know, and just everybody hit him. You know, they just look at him and hit him like, you know, he's a shoe shining boy. He just describes that he thought this was a way of communication. You know, this isn't the common. Instead of shaking hands, you got slapped. He's just everybody hit him, that was all. And finally, the way he got over, he made $50. And he took shiny shoes in Juarez. And he made it by boxing everybody. He shined the shoes of the soldiers. And they'd say, no, we don't want to shine. He'd say, well, I'll do it free. And so he shined their shoes free. Then he had a deal with a cop, and he yelled, he's not safe. And then he hopped and over. And the soldiers let them defy. And this way he made $50. So the only way he got over the border and shown the ropes was a bunch of campesinos came up, and they asked him to take him to his house so his mother could see him. And he said he didn't have a house, he didn't have a mother. And so finally he said, I've got $50. If you'll take me with you, I'll buy everything. Cigarettes, wine, everything. And they said, oh, you're too young, immigration will get you. But he had that $50, and so they took him across the river. And he bought all, everything, and followed him. And they were hitting him, you know, because he was keeping him from getting a job. And everybody said, go, they say, you know, he's too young, the immigration will see him, get him. And they tried to get him to stop following him, you know, they'd slap him here, slap him there. And he didn't know anything to do but follow him. Finally, each one of them got a job, but him. And he was left alone. So he went crying over the mountains, and he got very hot in the day, so he threw his jacket away. And at night, his hands froze. And he got so cold. And so finally, a miracle happened. He thought the United States was one place. He was looking for his brother in the United States, and he thought it was a town. He says, we're in the United States. And everybody says, you're in it. But he says, I'm not in it. My brother's in it. And this cold night, it seems impossible. He comes to a place, he goes and knocks on the door, and his brother opens the door. But the way he describes how he couldn't speak anything, you know, he couldn't speak the language. He didn't know, it was like Woody. Remember when Woody was in Mexico, he said, these people are, I can't quite understand them. he didn't believe it was another language, just what he just wasn't quite getting it.
He had another reaction when we went back to Tijuana when he was about, four. Between 4 and 5. And like, we stayed at this motel, and he came in. I came running in the door, and what's the matter? Well, those boys, I just said, they're going to beat me up, and they're going to do this, and they're going to do that. You know, it's a very complicated story. I looked out, and I could tell they were Mexican, and they had spoken in Spanish, you know. And I said, well, I hear what they say. What did they say exactly? And he repeated exactly the same thing in English. And, I said, well, you can't know what they said, because they don't speak English. Well, that's what they said. And I even went out, you know, and tried to talk to them in English. They didn't know any English. And I couldn't figure out what he meant by that. And then when we started to shop in Tijuana, and he discovered that whatever was in the front of the shop was being made in back. And when he discovered that, we'd open the door, and he'd shoot right straight through the shop to the back. And then when we get through shopping around in the shop, you know, I go in the back, and he's in there having a long conversation with the shoemaker, you know. But he talked English, and the guy would talk Spanish. And it didn't seem to make any difference. He'd say, well, then what's that? And he'd say, in Spanish, you know, you would be talking about the nails was in the shoe, you know, and stuff, and you pound it, and can I pound it? He'd say, here's a hammer, and he'd be pounding him. Neither one seemed to realize that they were talking the same language at all. But the law didn't seem to make any difference with the little kid. And I said, well, that, you don't know what he said to you. Yes, I know what he said. You put the nail in the shoe, and you found it. And he went, often will stop and see a letter. Then he's signing the back with some people making everything. And he'd be rushing back, you know, maybe he couldn't find the room right away. And he'd just think, where's he making? Where's he making? That's funny. I suppose he has some distant memory, which makes it familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the things that are talking about are terribly simple, really.
Well, I think it shows, though, that also that to people that are dealing with a reality, you know, touching something, the language comes after, not before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it was true with Mac. I think it was one of the things that and Mac had his stroke, you know, he was laughing there the first time I went to see him because they were holding up this egg and asking him to say it. And he couldn't say it, but he was laughing at them that they didn't know what it was. It was an egg. I mean, it was obvious. Why could you put a word on it? I mean, he'd lost all his sense of the, but he knew more what an egg was than he did when he knew how to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking this gibberish and telling me how foolish the doctors were. They come in every day and woke up an egg. And he knows what it is. And he asked me, don't they know what an egg is? What it is? And he was saying gag and goob and gag and everything but egg. But it didn't seem to, and I think it released a lot of his pain because, you know, he just dropped the word like a garment, you know, like a silly garment. That's the great thing about the Pueblo Indians. They speak later. I mean, speaking is just the tail end of everything.
Well, I've known kids, you know, like 5-year-olds who could not count. They didn't know the numbers at all. But when it would come their turn to serve juice, they could estimate, you know, if there were 25 kids, how many were absent, you know, and how many were left, and then set the table with the right number of juice glasses, you know, napkins, chairs, and it was quite complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And those children that could count would get, they were counting too soon, and they would get so mixed up in the counting that they would count everybody, and then they would have to subtract numbers, and they couldn't do it. And they said, always the wrong number.
Well, I think it's Piaget's book.
But that's hard to do because these little children are moving. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, even when I used to set the table for juice,
but just think
you know, I've already counted that one already, start again, you know, and
I think it's a beautiful complexity, though, of objects that you have a feeling for. If you're just not counting.
Yeah, well, you can see these children fall on the table with everybody at it, but not so-and-so, because, you know, so-and-so isn't here today, you know, not so-and-so. And then...
Oh, I see, they saw them.
Well, I don't know what they saw. They never, a lot of the children that couldn't count had an easier time arranging the things.
Well, that's something to do now with the relative destruction of numbers, of counting one thing beside another, you know, which just the quantity counting. You know, relativity destroyed all the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you know.
Well,
it's a magnetic field of force, you know, that everything is on, moving around each other and not side by side.
Well, it's also, if you learn counting too young, which is different for every child, but if you learn it too young, then you've learned the name of something that you don't have the concept for. Because there's only a certain amount you can learn at the same time.
That's true of everything, naming anything, I think.
So we used to do this games, you know, like you put a lot of things on the table and everybody closed their eyes and you remove something. And then everybody was out and what's gone. And they only have a second, you know, to see all the things. Not the number things gone, but what was gone. and that would confuse people who could count, because they would count things and give it numbers, and they wouldn't know what to name what was missing.
Well, if you get the concept of anything before you get the object, you're going to be abstract.
In Russia, they changed, you know, from the reading policy. I don't know where they are now, but a couple of years ago, they quit teaching reading until, I think, the second grade. And just gave them a background of Russian literature. And before they stopped me reading, I think it's very good.
I think the reading is too early. You're bound to get the concept before.
So when was it? There was some great education. Woe well, to the child who has his nose in the book before he's seen the world. Mm-hmm. Or something like that.
Start, you were reading it from start. About his own life.
Yeah, that's a terrific book.
And then he used the
every
Bible.
Reading teacher on it. That book. He doesn't say that really it was bad or good. He just says what, you know, what was, and he happened to make something out of it. But you could just see how thousands of kids wouldn't.
But he also shows in that book how he missed reality.
Yeah, but he doesn't say it's bad, though. He says, this is what I am, and I wouldn't have done these things. I'm happy with what I did, and I wouldn't have done them if I hadn't had this kind of, you know, background. But he's also saying that that's how I turned out, but that doesn't mean everybody does. You know,
well, I think in the book he's not saying that he turned out very well.
I think
he's missed, you know, the physical impact and collision of life through using verbalism as a clever way, a social device.
Yeah, but he also says that he did write these things, and writing, you know, did turn out to be his life. Well, you might say, in spite of. You know, he just says, well, these are the things that created me. And he doesn't say I'm great or poor or good or bad, you know, or things like that. This is what created me. But if you look at it educationally, you say, well, my God, there's no background for anything human.
No, he's a monster.
Well, I think you have to come to the conclusion that he's a monster, because
I do from the book. I mean, he says it kind of to me in the way that he depicts his mother and father and his youth.
But the fact that he does it then turns out to be, you're glad. I mean, he says, I'm glad because, I mean, I can't be glad about something that doesn't exist. I can only be glad about what does. You know, here I am. But also at the same time, you know, he's saying that there's no formula for great living. Mm-hmm. Do you want something?
Nope.
Not with your money. You know, you don't sit around on it.
What was the cash? That's unusual. I mean, it's true to get that. And you get sick. That March, April, May, in 4 months?
Mm. 2 of those months I got to pay more rent. 100, if I stay here. 111, but I get my insurance money back as soon as it goes through.
What about the tax?
And the taxes. I don't pay the next installment. That's $50. So, I get about 150 plus insurance, be, I don't know how much that is, I'll say $60 or something like that, and there's 60. They might save me $500 on the prepayment penalty. So I might squeeze out about $800 on little details, maybe. If they save me the pre-penalty payment.
That's a big time. We're
paying off the mortgage ahead of time. I don't know what my deal is on that. Sometimes you don't, it's not in there after a certain amount. You can pay off without paying it.
Let's go to the farmer's market and get mountains of oranges.
They're only come a year.
Mm-hmm.
You can get something sweet. You can get carrots.
We got mountains of oranges the other day. Delicious.
Yeah, but that's, those are imported.
Well, I don't care if they're imported or
exported. I mean, they wouldn't be at the farmer's market.
Well, whatever they have, don't argue with me there.
They have no good lettuce now.
No
they
good
have,
lettuce.
They have carrots.
We got carrots.
And I was going to make carrot juice. That'd be good.
Oh, well, I use no sunny. Well, are the oranges coming in here in September? Or are the first cows come in?
In March. Those nice, thick skin ones, I think I floored it.
Where'd you get that big bowl of oranges you got the other day?
Safeway. Safeway has all the imported stuff that's good and cheap. What else do they have? Something else that's in there. Mm-hmm.
Turnips?
Yeah, I think they're turnips. They're not too cheap, no.
Those were delicious little ones you got the other day. They were so small.
Yeah, they were from farmers.
I was at some of the farmer's Tabor, Iowa, and he had a turnip that big. And I said, oh, I don't want that turnip. I remember those kind of turnips in my youth. He said, I'm going to the horses. And he said, I'll give it to you free. Said, that is the most tender turnip all the way through. I said, but it's impossible. It's a big grain root. You just take it. I said, won't cost you anything. And it was true. It was just a whole great big tender turnip. This is an old man that's about 90 years old who's lived with his sister all his life. And she's 92.
Sounds like a crackling.
Yeah. And the two of them, they look like a male and female sea captain. He has those blue eyes. And this high color, like Modigliani painting workers. You know, but you don't believe it until you see workers have it. And rose, pink, burnt. And then these blue eyes. And they lived in that house, so they're sitting there all their lives. And they've grown out of this one garden, all of this vegetable. 92 years. And you put them out on a curb, and you stop them from coming out. Tabor. Did I say that Sam Davis had a heart attack?
Yeah.
I did?
Yeah, I think I didn't get called or something.
But he talked to his brother in the booth. Now, I don't know, this illness has brought her back to her family that she, you know, calls her father.
Mm-hmm.
And her father's.
Yeah, it was funny. I said, how did you ever call a cousin of yours to come take care of you? She's mad at her. And she said, well, you know how it is, Deborah, so when you're very sick, you revert. And all I remembered was our childhood together. She was my sister. I forgot all about what she grew up to. That was the maddest thing, huh?
Did she take care of her? Was she tender?
Well, she was a nurse, you know. I mean, a nurse. And she gets saying, well, I've been a nurse, so I know all about these things, you know. So, well, you can't do a thing with Irene, you can't do a thing, so you just don't know what to do. I mean, you do this and you do that, I mean, how do you know what you want to do? Well, so you try. I try, and I still don't know what to do. I don't know if it's right, if it's wrong, but I keep on trying. But then, you know, it doesn't do any good. I mean, I'm just, you know, complaining about this. Well, I suppose she complains about anything. I mean, a person's sick, they can complain. they're not gonna feel, they don't feel good. So they complain, they gotta expect that, don't you? Well, I just feel bad. I mean, I'm doing the best I can, but I gotta get out of here.
Oh, she's the one who I just wonder if Irene had to tell her to go.
Oh, she couldn't stand it. And shopping the Safeway. She had everybody in hysterics. She asked for the strange things I never even heard of. Well, what's for you? I mean, you shopping in a strange shop? You don't know where the things are? You're racing around? I don't know if I would have, or Irene wants this or that. I mean, nothing I get is any good. Because, she's sick and she doesn't like anything, I suppose. So I can only do the best I can. So I'll get this cup of coffee. She doesn't like it. What am I going to do? I'll come back and I'll get another cup of coffee. She thought I won't like that either.
You know, if you had an interesting letter. I think your letters are very interesting. On a typewriter, I was so surprised.
I get, you know, that's a Jewish thing too. You say the things the three different ways. You know, I mean, one, you know, the question is, what shall I choose? If I choose this, it's probably not going to be any good. If I choose that, it might not be the right kind. But on the other hand, no matter what, either one that I choose, if a person's sick, they're not going to like it anyway. So what can you do?
They are caught. Was it Tevye who came back? Was it Tevye that came back with a female goat? The kind of guy in the village? It was a buck? A goat?
Yeah, well, she kind of just, she says, I'm going to give you money. She says, I want you to come back and I'm going to bring me a goat. And it's got to be a female goat. Can I trust you on it? He says, wait, I don't know about female goat. I don't know whether a male goat that will give you. And he goes off in the town to play trick for him.
They change it.
And then the priest says, so finally they call the rabbi in the one town, and he writes the paper that it is a male goat. And he goes, that's where he bought it, and the rabbi thereby writes the paper saying, no, it's a female goat that he bought. And so then what to do about that? And the rabbi says, it's obvious that female goats are male goats here, and male goats are female goats here. Since I'm not planning even to move Kelsey, and that it is, that it isn't better to, I mean, because a couple of thousand makes a lot of difference to me.
Yeah, how do you know you're not going to get a couple thousand less in 2 months?
I don't think I'll get a couple thousand less.
It's just the problem. You know, the market has been slow.
Yeah.
And the money is very tight.
But likely the market will be better than...
I don't know. It certainly hasn't been for the last year. Right now, the market has picked up a little bit. Look, as I told you, I think you ought to take this. And I